Welcome to Future of Freedom. I'm your host, Scott Bertram. Future of Freedom is a production of America's Talking Network. You can check out all of our great podcasts at americastalking.com. Joining me today is Ovik Roy. He is president of the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. You can find more at freopp.org. Previously, he was a member of Mitt Romney's presidential campaign as healthcare policy advisor in 2012, Forbes opinion editor in 2014, also worked for Texas Governor Rick Perry's presidential campaign and later for Florida Senator Marco Rubio. He's been with the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity since 2016. Ovik Roy, thanks so much for joining us here on Future of Freedom.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me.
So we begin by asking you to tell us about the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity, and specifically, why does it exist? What is the mission?
You know, when you start a new think tank, and we started this think tank, as you mentioned, in 2016, we felt that there was a real need for a new think tank. Now, that may strike a lot of people as counterintuitive, who, particularly those who think of think tanks as places where you go to just kind of sit around and chew the cud and not really actually have an impact on the world. But we felt quite the opposite. So I, as you mentioned, I worked on three presidential campaigns, Mitt Romney's in 2012, and then Rick Perry's and Marco Rubio's in the 16 cycle. And one thing that I learned working on all three of those presidential campaigns and being observing very closely many others is that presidential candidates really depend on think tanks. Mm-hmm. Because let's say, Scott, you're running for president and you have some very young, smart whippersnapper from Hillsdale College as your policy chief. And you say to that whippersnapper, hey, I really want to have an alternative to Bernie Sanders' free college for everyone plan. I want to genuinely address the problems of student debt, but, you know, I don't want a socialist solution. I want a solution that's more pro-liberty. Well, that young whippersnapper may be a genius and be able to come up with such a plan on his own, but 99.8% of the time, that's not going to be the case. That whippersnapper is going to reach out to the think tanks that align with you philosophically and say, okay, who are the experts at this think tank who've worked on student debt, on higher ed policy? And after you look at all their research and talk to them, you're going to say, okay, I'm going to triangulate or synthesize from there and come up with something. And so it turns out the bench on the pro-liberty side is really thin. And I learned this firsthand working for a long time, as many of your listeners will know, on healthcare policy, mm-hmm. where my whole thing after Obamacare passed was, okay, if you want to have a repeal and replacement or you want to have an alternative approach to health reform, you got to be able to get 60 votes in the Senate. That is the threshold, right? So it's not enough to just say, I'm going to, you know, go on a blackboard and chalk up my, you know, libertarian dream plan of how we get the government out of healthcare. You actually have to have an approach that can get enough public support and enough political support to pass the House, pass the Senate, and be signed into law by the president. And that requires a lot more subtlety and discipline and technical knowledge, let alone just understanding, because healthcare is so complicated, how you actually design a policy that works and that makes people better off. So what the healthcare debate of the 2010s taught me was that people on the pro-freedom side really had not been thinking hard enough about how to get 60 votes in the Senate on healthcare. And that's not just true on healthcare, that's true on a lot of issues. And it really matters, because we talk a lot about the debt. We talk a lot about the deficit and how terrible it is that, you know, government is getting bigger and bigger every year, blah, blah, blah. But unless you actually have a plan to reform those runaway sources of federal spending, like Medicare, like Medicaid, you're not going to be able to actually solve any problems. Reverse engineering from there. How do you get 60 votes for pro-freedom policies? How do you attract the electorate of the future for pro-freedom policies, a more diverse, younger generation that's been educated in a different way than maybe you and I were, Scott, but has a different worldview, but not necessarily a socialist worldview, just a worldview in which they expect that American economics, American society should be inclusive. It should be fair. Everyone should have a fair shot at success. That's an eternal American principle, the idea that everyone should have a fair shot at success. In the old days, we used to say that's what makes America exceptional.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that you can come here from anywhere, you can rise up from any background and make your life and your children's lives better. And the hypothesis, the insight that we came up with is that if you want to attract both Democrats and Republicans to a pro-freedom agenda, you have to center everything you do around how liberty makes life better for Americans on the bottom half of the economic ladder. You have to show that freedom is, in fact, the most progressive idea that humanity has ever invented, that freedom and individual liberty and economic freedom are the greatest engines of equality that humanity has ever invented. And that's not usually how we approach these issues, John. Usually we say we like freedom because freedom is good, or we like freedom because we like people to leave us alone and let us keep our stuff. And what I'm trying to make the case for, and what FreeOp is making the case for, is that the strongest argument, the strongest moral argument for freedom is that I am my brother's keeper, and the people around me will be better off if they are able to benefit from the fruits of liberty.
I want to ask about a couple of words and phrases, perhaps. One, as I hear you explain the ideas behind the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity, the word prudence comes to mind, the politics of the possible. Is it more difficult to find those who will carry your messages forward because they are not necessarily of the parties? Is it difficult to find people who are enthusiastic and who are animated about the policies prescribed by the foundation because they are not rising from one of the wings of the two major parties?
Well, I thought you were going to talk about The Politics of Prudence, which, of course, is a famous book by Russell Kirk. I would say that there's a couple of points to make there. One, is that there's a counter argument to prudence, right? The counter argument made by, shall we say, like people with a more radical temperament about prudence is that prudence is not it doesn't overcome the relentless resistance of the other side,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you try to be prudential, you can't get very far. And I think that is a bit of a false dichotomy. So the dichotomy of the squishy moderates who get nothing done being prudent and the radicals who also get nothing done because they can't win agreement from the other side. You have to actually have a strategy if you want to achieve change, you have to have a strategy that marries both principles. You have to have a moral foundation and a kind of philosophical foundation that drives you forward and gives you a long-term goal. But you also have to understand that if you want to achieve that long-term goal, there's a lot of little hurdles and blocking and tackling and unglamorous work
mm-hmm.
that goes into achieving those goals that does involve a more pragmatic consideration. So it's both at the same time. And I think that's been the big problem on the right. And again, if we take healthcare as an example, the more radical ideological temperament would be something like, well, you know, if you try to do something that can get 60 votes in the Senate, then you're accepting the principle that the federal government should be involved in healthcare. And I, the truly principled libertarian conservative, I will never accept that compromise. And if you think that the federal government has a role in healthcare, then you're just a squish.
Mm-hmm.
And the prudential person might say, well, you know, well, we can't really change anything because the lobbyists will say no. And so we're just going to, you know, really tweak around the edges. And I would say the synthesis of those two is to say, no, we've got to solve the entitlement problem because it's bankrupting America and bankrupting patients. So we've got to really work hard to do that. And so we need meaningful change from the system we have today. But yes, it's true that Americans, we do live in a republic or a democracy or whatever you want to call it. Americans do want there to be a safety net for people who fall down on their luck and are unable to otherwise have health insurance. There is a legitimate role for public policy to solve that problem of someone who is otherwise uninsured and at risk of going bankrupt due to healthcare bills. So we do have to accept some role for the government to be involved in health insurance if we want that role to be limited. If we say there's no legitimate role for government, then the socialists are going to win the argument because American people want something, not nothing. So you really have to have a solution that is targeted to the problem that people are trying to solve, and that is maximally pro-freedom.
Ovik Roy is with us here on the Future of Freedom podcast. He's the president of the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. Right in the name is Equal Opportunity. You mentioned previously that those younger than you and I may have been raised a little differently with different expectations. And there's now this different word that is being used very often in place of equal opportunity, and that is this idea of equity. Is there common ground to be found with people who speak of equity and not equal opportunity?
Well, one thing I think a lot of people in the liberty and conservative movement do is they decide that if the left uses a word, that we have to be against the word. So for example, the left says, we're for universal coverage, by which they mean single payer healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And so the right then says, we're against everybody having health insurance because that's a left wing thing. It's like, no, are we against everybody having a car? Are we against everybody having a cell phone? Are we against everybody having a laptop? No, we're for universal cell phones and universal laptops. And for every American to have access to a good education, why can't we be for everyone having access to health insurance, universal health insurance, just through the private sector, through freedom of choice and competition, right? Same thing with affordable housing. You hear people say, well, the left constantly talks about affordable housing, so we have to be against affordable housing. Well, why? Why can't we just show that the way to achieve affordable housing is through a free market where we embrace growth in the supply of housing and support the reform of regulations that restrict growth in the supply of housing. That's how you lower the price of housing, is enable there to be more housing built, right? So similarly with equity, I think the key there is how do you define it, right? If we define equity to mean a system of racial spoils where your great grandparents came from is what's going to define what we allocate to you resource-wise, that is a system that hopefully we all oppose, or most of us oppose and think is terrible, right? But if we think of equity in the way that the term is used in financial markets, right? So when you buy 100 shares of Apple, you own equity. You own an equity stake in Apple, the company. You are a part owner of Apple, right? If we think of equity in that way, then the idea that every American should have equity, an actual ownership stake in the success of America, is an idea that goes back to John Locke, right? Who believed that property ownership was the way to secure the stability of a republic because property owners were the ones who had the most stake in an ordered liberty, right? So I would say, if the left wants to use the term equity, they're really talking our language because the term equity is an economic term.
Mm-hmm.
And what we should do is show that the way to achieve equity is to ensure that as many Americans as possible have a sense of ownership in the success of America.
Recently, Newt Gingrich published an op-ed. I want to read a bit from it for you. He said, Republicans must learn to talk about a new American majority, not a Republican majority. They must plan, think, and act for the American majority. This emerging new American majority requires base broadening, not base mobilization strategies. Reaching all of the majority requires new thinking, that's underlined, about policy development, language, scheduling, and coalition building. Is Newt talking your language here? Do you see the opportunity for, say, a new sort of fusion out there?
Yes. I mean, well, the way I would put it is fusionism is this. There's two different things you're describing, fusionism and a coalition, which are not exactly the same thing, right? So if we're talking about Frank Meyer's fusionism, where he makes the argument that liberty cannot exist without virtue, and virtue cannot exist without liberty. That's a specific argument. The coalition is a little bit of a different argument, which is that the libertarians and the social conservatives and the anti-communists back in the 20th century should all work together, even though they actually don't agree. Mm-hmm. They're not actually fusing their ideas so much as agreeing to work together for a common goal, even if they disagree about certain things. And I think that latter concept is they're both relevant to what the pro-liberty movement should look like in the future. But I'd say that coalition piece is especially important. How do you build a new coalition? Well, the coalition that existed post 1964 was one that that attracted a lot of people who were opposed to civil rights. This is something that I think our movement is not always to spend a lot of time thinking about. But what Goldwater did by winning 60 states in the Deep South and losing the other 44 was he created a coalition of libertarians, yes, social conservatives, yes, anti-communists, yes, but also Southern Democrats who were not so thrilled about the Civil Rights Act in 1964. That may have worked in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, but in 2020, it's a complete disaster because we have a country that is not only more diverse racially and ethnically than it ever has been, but a country that I think really has committed itself, rightly so, to the principle of racial equality. And again, as we talked about earlier, there are some people on the far left who are trying to undermine that principle of racial equality. But I think why the civil rights movement of the 60s worked is because that principle of equal opportunity, the principle behind free up, the principle behind America, is one that people of all races and all ethnicities believe in this country. We all believe that everyone, regardless of their background, should have a fair shot at success. And so that's something that if you ask any Republican, you ask any conservative, ask any libertarian, they'll say, oh yeah, we believe that. But operationally, that has not been the coalition that the Republican Party has embraced. Now, maybe part of that is that we are wrong to connect the conservative movement to the Republican Party, and we should be more understanding of the fact that both parties have their pro-liberty or pro-conservative elements and be less partisan in our thinking. That's part of, I think, part of where you have to go. But if you want one of the two parties to be a party that reflects conservative principles, then the coalition absolutely has to be modernized. The 1955 coalition of Bill Buckley and Barry Goldwater is not workable today because the country is very different than it was in 1955. And so you need those working class African Americans and Hispanics. You need those kitchen table voters who are looking to someone to show them, you know, just the economic principles. I want good jobs. I want good wages. I don't want inflation. I don't want my cost of living to go up. I want my health care to be affordable. I want my education to be affordable. So there has to be a real refocus on economic policy. I think so much of politics today has become culture war, largely driven by, I think, cable news and social media, where the coverage of culture war issues becomes so dominant. And this is not to say that culture war issues don't matter. It's just to say that we don't have a balance between talking about issues like, whether or not you can go to college and be yourself and share mainstream views on a college campus. That's important for the third of Americans who go to college. But we also need to talk about the two-thirds of people who don't go to college and are just looking to get a decent job and live their lives.
Let's talk a bit about education. There's some research at the website, freopp.org, about education options for low-income families. There are many charter school opportunities for low-income residents in, say, Detroit, Michigan, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. This is an issue. Generally, look at polling, it's a 70-30, 75-25 kind of issue. And yet in many states, it's impossible to get traction on expanding these educational opportunities for low-income families or any families in those states. If you have the public support on an issue like education options, education choice, what are those hurdles that are still in front of you in making the policy change?
Well, you're bringing up something that reminds me of two things. First, one thing I should mention about FREOP, about the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity, aside from the broader mission of expanding economic opportunity to those who least have it, using the tools of individual liberty and free enterprise and technological innovation and pluralism, one thing that we do is that we require that everything our scholars work on center its arguments around how a particular pro-freedom policy improves the lives of Americans whose incomes or worth are below the U.S. median. If we can't convince ourselves that that's the case, then we won't work on it. And that keeps us focused, that keeps us from being distracted, and that makes sure, that ensures that all of our work is, it redoubles our commitment to that mission and that vision. And charter schools is a great example, right? So it's something that I think a lot of conservatives and libertarians understand. It's like, hey, if you actually give people the tools to go to the school of their choice, the quality of the education that particularly lower-income people have is going to go up. But here's the interesting thing. What has been the obstacle to broader educational choice? It's been upper-middle-class people who are like, hey, I spent all this money to live in this fancy suburb. I pay property taxes so that my kids can go to this fancy public school. And you're telling me that that kid from the ghetto can now go to the school too? What are you talking about? School choice, educational choice, is actually a form of redistribution. It's a redistribution of wealth, right? Because we're saying that, yes, that kid from the inner city is going to have access to an education that's comparable to that that you get in a fancy suburb. So that is an area where conservatives and libertarians have understood the value of a redistributionist agenda, in a sense, in accomplishing a form of freedom, educational choice. We should not have a system in which the school you go to is tied to the place that you were forced to grow up. What's been interesting, the innovation, why charter schools have been so successful, is they were kind of an end run around this process. With conventional school choice, which was kid from inner city gets to go to the public school in fancy suburb, the people who lived in the fancy suburb didn't like that because they didn't like the redistributionist element of that. What charter schools did is said, look, you fancy suburbanites, you can have your fancy public school. What we're going to do is we're going to build this third school that kids from both the fancy suburb and the inner city can go to, and it'll be a lottery system. And that way, your fancy suburban school is just going to be fine. You can still go to that. But all these other kids will still have this other alternative to the school that they're going to now. And that has unlocked the revolution of educational choice. So that's, in a sense, a pragmatic, politically pragmatic solution. I said, okay, traditional school choice is something that, you know, upper middle class people are going to resist. Oh, but if we do this thing with charter schools, they're not going to be as upset, and we can still solve the problem of kids trapped in terrible schools. And so that has been an incredible success. Now, the really cool thing, and this gets back to your question, is charter schools only get you so far because there are only so many charter schools, and the teachers' unions and others try to block the construction of new charter schools. And by the way, in a world in which technology is exploding and the ability to learn things from Khan Academy on your computer or your iPad, you know, a lot of things you don't need to do in a traditional brick and mortar school. So how do we actually open up those opportunities for more kids? And that was the one of the insights behind our education scholar Dan Lipps's insight and proposal in 2005 to say, let's give every kid in Arizona, he was working in Arizona at the time, let's give every kid in Arizona an education savings account that's like a health savings account, but for educational opportunities. And you can use it for school, you can use it for tutoring, you can use it to buy books. So it's not just about school choice, it's about the broad menu of things that help you learn. Fast forward 17 years, Arizona Governor Doug Ducey, just a couple weeks ago, enacted into law a bill that takes the state-funded portion of your school money and gives that to the parents, about $7,000 per kid, if I recall correctly, to fund an education savings account for every kid in Arizona. That is a thunderbolt revolutionary idea that, again, just shows the power of think tanks. So we started with, okay, what's the point of starting a think tank? Here was an idea that Dan wrote about in 2005. It took a long time. It took a bunch of Supreme Court cases to open up the ability to do this, because it used to, if you gave somebody an ESA and they went to a religious school, that was considered somehow illegal. So now that we have that open field to actually achieve the policy, the policy is now law in Arizona, and our goal is to make that the law in many other states.
When it comes to healthcare, your rise to fame, as it is, largely was in the Obamacare fight as a sharp, intelligent critic of the Affordable Care Act, of Obamacare. That was, more than a decade ago at this point. And people can read your health reform plan on the FreeOp website. It's called Medicare Advantage for All, a patient-centered plan for universal coverage and permanent fiscal solvency. The free market case for universal coverage you talk about there as well. Are the policies that you lay out now for FreeOp the same ones that people might remember you talking about, again, a decade or 12 years ago? Have you shifted at all your philosophy on what is perhaps prudent and possible in the world of healthcare?
There's definitely, I'd say the core principles, the core elements are the same, but there certainly are some differences and refinements, and we've worked on new ideas and added and layered on things over time as we've encountered other good ideas from other people. So there's a lot of stuff in there. If you actually just Google FreeOp and then Medicare Advantage for All, you'll find a lot of the research, or you can go to FreeOp Universal Coverage. Actually, is a better place to look, because then you see the broad range of stuff. But the four core principles are the same. Principle number one is that free market health reform, or health reform in general, needs to be affordable for every generation, not just for every person living in America today who should have access to affordable health insurance, but also it should be affordable for the generations of the future. Meaning, if we do the Bernie Sanders plan, and you give everyone health insurance in a heavily subsidized way so that future generations go broke, then you haven't solved the problem. You've just dumped the problem on future generations. So you have to do it in a way that's fiscally sustainable as well as universally affordable. So that's principle number one, affordable for every generation. Principle number two is that people should have the freedom to choose among a wide variety of private plans that are customized to suit their needs. Their insurance should be personalized. And that's really important, because what does the left say? The left says you should have one choice, a one-size-fits-all option imposed on you by the government. Now, having said that, the status quo is not that different. If you get insurance from your employer today, you've also been handed a single choice from your employer. Now, that may be a private insurance plan, but you also have a one-size-fits-all plan for everyone who works at that company. So the status quo is not personalized either. And that's a real opportunity for reformers to say, you know what? We want you to have a system where neither the government nor your employer gets to dictate to you what your health insurance should look like. You get to choose the health insurance that's best for you and your family. So personalized insurance. Principle number three, fairness to taxpayers. So right now we have this crazy system where, Scott, you and I pay taxes so that Mitt Romney and Warren Buffett can have government-subsidized health insurance because they're old enough to be on Medicare, and they get to have government-subsidized health insurance because they're 65. Why is it that people worth $300 million or $1 billion or whatever get government-subsidized health insurance? That's crazy, right? We should have a system in which people who genuinely need the help get assistance, and those who don't. And we call that fairness to taxpayer. Taxpayer-funded subsidies should be reserved for the poor, the sick, and the vulnerable, not the wealthy. If you do that, you could save an enormous amount of money in our healthcare system. And then the last thing is innovation and competition for patients. That if you really want a better healthcare system that has the best health outcomes for the most people, you've got to make sure that we preserve and enhance the elements of our system that lead to technological innovation. And you also have to encourage competition where there are monopolies right now in America so that people can compete to lower costs and increase quality for patients. And that is a big problem in America. We have a lot of consolidation in a lot of parts of the country. There's one hospital system that owns the entire state or that owns the entire chunk of the state. And you don't have a lot of choice as to where you get your care when you get sick. And as a result, those regional monopolies can raise prices on you without much pushback. So that's something we got to fix.
Ovik Roy is with us. He's president of the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. Energy costs are a huge deal for all Americans, but especially lower-income Americans, and especially at a time of rising inflation. As we look toward addressing the inflation issue and just toward the future overall, should we be confident that free markets always will work in the best interests of those lower income Americans that FreeOp focuses on?
Truly, free markets do work in the best interests of lower income Americans. The problem in America is we don't have many truly free markets. We have markets that are heavily subsidized. We have markets where regulators have created barriers to entry to new innovators and new competitors. And for various other reasons, we don't always have the freedom of choice. Sometimes it's consolidation, monopoly power that prevent Americans from having choice in the way they experience the world. So there are a lot of things about our system that are not free. And I think that's been one of the mistakes of the conservative movement, is there's been a conflation of the private sector and free markets. Just because a monopoly is a private company doesn't mean that the existence of that monopoly represents a free market, right? If you don't have a choice between competing products, there's no market. You have one monopoly dictating how things go. And anyone who's dealt with like a cable company monopoly or a telephone company monopoly or any other part of your life where there's only one player in your part of the world, you understand that monopolies are just as bureaucratic, just as unconcerned with your interests as government monopolies are, and basically for the same reason. So I think one blind spot of a lot of Republicans, a lot of conservatives, and a lot of libertarians has been how important it is for us to have a genuinely competitive system. Now, your question was about energy. And energy is an interesting example, because energy is both something that benefits from free markets in the sense that the more free your market is for energy, the more ability you're going to have low-cost energy. And low-cost energy is incredibly beneficial because it affects the cost of everything. So that's good. Mm-hmm. However, there's a degree to which energy is also a strategic good. I mean, literally, why did the Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor? Because they were worried that their supply of oil was going to dry up if they didn't engage in war with the U.S. So energy has always been a really important strategic and geopolitical entity, not merely an economic entity. I mean, it's both. I mean, the reason it's a geopolitical entity is because it's so important economically. And so energy independence, for example, is something that we had achieved in America until very recently, when the Biden administration basically said, we want to suppress the growth and the development of fossil fuels. We want to actually restrict the production of fossil fuels because we think that will serve the broader goals of the climate. But if you look around the world, where is there more pollution? Where is there more carbon emission? Where markets have not been as entrenched as they are in the United States. Where there's markets, there's more demand for low polluting sources of energy. There's more demand for low carbon sources of energy. An example where we've really failed is nuclear energy. So we actually have a paper coming out pretty soon on how since 1974, so basically there's been this 50-year regime, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was established in 1974 to regulate the U.S. nuclear energy market. And literally since then, there's not been a single new nuclear plant approved by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Mm-hmm. Their approach has been, well, there's a theoretical risk that nuclear power is dangerous. Therefore, unless you convince us that there's an infinitely zero, effectively zero chance of anything going wrong, we're not going to approve a nuclear plant. And what's the end result? It's become incredibly expensive to develop a nuclear plant, which makes nuclear power too expensive and uncompetitive with other forms of energy. And then the best opportunity for us to have abundant, reliable, low-carbon energy has been basically taken off the table. So that's an example of where if there were a real market for nuclear energy and we had a more scientifically grounded approach to the safety of nuclear energy would be cheaper. There's incredible technological innovation going on in the nuclear energy space. We could have nuclear energy powering so many of our cities, so many of our buildings, so many of our data centers. And carbon reduction would happen automatically. We're already seeing that. Like, we didn't sign the Kyoto protocols for carbon emissions.
Right.
And yet the U.S. is the only country that actually met the targets because of natural gas and the innovation that came from unconventional exploration, hydraulic fracturing or fracking, that liberated an incredible reservoir of natural gas in the United States, because natural gas is cleaner than coal and crude oil. We've actually reduced our carbon emissions, right? So this is a long and circuitous answer to your question, but the point is free markets have done more in the U.S. to reduce carbon emissions than a more centrally planned approach in Europe has achieved.
Ovik Roy is president of the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. You can find them at FREOPP.org. You can find Ovik Roy on Twitter as well, at AVIK. Ovik Roy, thanks so much for joining us here on the Future of Freedom podcast.
Hey, thanks, Scott. And I would just add that if people want to follow more of our work, you can subscribe to our Substack newsletter, which is substack.freeop.org. And that's a good way to keep up on our latest research.
I'm Scott Bertram. For more episodes of the Future of Freedom podcast and other fine productions of America's Talking Network, check out americastalking.com or wherever you find your podcasts. Thank you for listening to Future of Freedom, presented by America's Talking Network.